It's one of those true crime mysteries that just nags at people. You always see it on lists of cases people most wish would be solved. Two teenagers and one of their moms simply vanished into the night back in 1992, with only a broken porch light and an answering machine message to provide any clues. This is the story of the Springfield Three, the missing Missouri women who continue to fascinate us decades later. Hi friends, I'm Katie, and this is Katie Does Crime. Thank you for joining me for the first time if you're new here, and hello to the usual rapscallions and reprobates. Please consider subscribing or joining me on Patreon if you'd like to hear more true crime stories. Today's case was recommended by Leslie Sunshine 17, and I always appreciate the ideas, so keep them coming. This one was only a little familiar to me, so I'd especially love to hear your thoughts if you're one of those people who's studied it extensively. So it was Sunday, June 7th, 1992, when officers arrived at the little ranch house on Delmar Street in Springfield, Missouri. School friends Suzanne, Susie, 19, and Stacy, 18, had been at Kickapoo High graduation parties the night before until 2 a.m. They stopped by another friend's house for a minute, found that it was too crowded, and decided to go back to Susie's for a sleepover in her new king-size waterbed instead. They agreed to meet up the next morning to go to the Whitewater Park in Branson. One thing I love is that these girls were out until after 2 a.m., and then their friends started calling them about going to the water park at 7:30 a.m., and was concerned when they didn't answer. High schoolers, get some sleep before real life kicks in. The friend kept only getting the answering machine, so finally at 12:30 p.m., she and her boyfriend decided to drive over to the house to wake Susie and Stacy up. Both of their red cars were in the driveway, and Susie's mom's car was in the carport attached to the house. The porch light was still on, even though it was midday, and the globe, the glass that covers the bulb, was broken and scattered all over the front steps. The friend was barefoot, which I find to be such a delightful little detail as someone who grew up totally redneck and was always barefoot. But those of you who know this story know that this is one of those tiny little things that may have affected the entire case. The boyfriend, being a nice Midwestern boy, found a broom and cleaned up the glass as a favor to Susie's mom, and so his girlfriend wouldn't cut her feet. He disposed of the shards in the garage, and then they rang the front doorbell and knocked on the door several times. Nothing. But the door was unlocked, as doors often were in the country in the 90s, so they just called out and let themselves in. The house was quiet except for a TV in Susie's bedroom and the yapping of Susie's little Yorkie. Nothing seemed too odd, like there weren't obvious signs of a struggle, but it seemed really weird that the three women weren't in the house, and yet their cars were in the driveway. According to the original police report, their purses were just sitting in Susie's bedroom. And even weirder for chain smokers, their cigarettes were left behind too. The friend and her boyfriend left to check another friend's house, came back, and then left to check the local sub shop. Nothing. They eventually talked to Stacy's mom, who was mostly mad that Stacy had spent the night with Susie when she said she'd be at this other friend's house. Stacy knew her mom required a phone call to keep tabs on Stacy's whereabouts, or she'd worry. But it didn't seem like such a big deal at this point. The friend and the boyfriend had eventually even gone to a nearby water slide to pass the time now that the trip to Branson seemed out of the question. But with no call from Susie and Stacy late into the evening, they all met up at Susie's house as the sky grew dark. Stacy's mom noticed that her migraine medication was left behind, and she always carried that with her. Her shorts were also sitting there on the floor with her jewelry tucked into the pockets. Was she out gallivanting in her underwear? They called the police, who arrived to find that other friends and family had gathered, 18 of them just walking through what would later become a crime scene, cleaning up ashtrays and washing coffee cups as they went. But the only real evidence of foul play was that broken porch light that had been cleaned up and dumped, so one officer just taped a note on the door to call and cancel the missing persons report when the women got home. Stacy McCall, born April 23, 1974, had met Susie Streeter, born March 9, 1973, in second grade. They were part of a best friends trio with another close friend, the one who was supposed to go with them to the water park that day. Stacy's family moved away for a little while before returning to Springfield, and the two ran in slightly different circles after that. It sounds like Spacey Stacy was a little more of the cheerleader type, and Susie was a little more of the wild child. Susie Streeter had a custom license plate that said Sweeter, and she was known to either be absolute best friends with her mom or to be moving out and living with her boyfriend or her brother. Friends say she just wanted her independence sometimes. She had a bad boy boyfriend and a birthmark on her chin that embarrassed her. Stacy, on the other hand, cared more about her grades than boyfriends and modeled wedding gowns for a local shop. But despite their differences, with graduation looming and knowing that Stacy was planning to be a sorority girl at Southwest Missouri State and Susie was going to cosmetology school, they wanted to make the most of their time together. They'd become closer than ever over the few months leading up to their disappearance. The next day, June 8th, there was still no news, despite checking local hospitals to see if a woman without a name had been brought in. Susie's mom, 47-year-old Cheryl Levitt, hadn't shown up to her job as a cosmetologist. Stacy's mom knew the story of Adam Walsh, the little boy who had disappeared from a mall in 1981, from TV, and knew that she needed to start getting posters up and getting the media to pay attention to the case. Little did she know that Adam's father, the host of the show America's Most Wanted, would soon be talking about her daughter on his program. When the tips started coming in, they were taken seriously even when time after time they amounted to nothing. The police would follow circling buzzards, consult psychics, try tarot cards, comb the county on ATVs and horses, and follow every lead. Here are just a few of them. One, neighbors reported a homeless man near Susie and Cheryl's house 3 times in 2 days before the disappearance, and a sketch was released. Two, another neighbor saw a green Dodge van pull up to the house on the day of the disappearance with what looked like Susie in the driver's seat. This neighbor heard a man say, "Don't do anything stupid." A dark blue van was stolen in Springfield at around the same time. A brown van was also reported as being shady. Three, a waitress at one of Cheryl's favorite restaurants says she saw all three of the women there on June 7th between 1 and 3 a.m., and Susie appeared drunk. Four, a convenience store clerk said that Cheryl came rushing in at 2:15 that morning looking for Susie and her friends. Five, someone called into America's Most Wanted with seemingly solid evidence, but when the operator tried to patch him through to the police, the call was cut off. Six, a tip from a psychic supposedly said that the women's bodies could be found beneath a hospital parking garage in Springfield, and a local writer had ground-penetrating radar used on the scene. The engineer using the radar said he could pick up 3 distinct objects. But police said no solid evidence was ever provided, the garage was built a whole year after the women disappeared, and this vague finding wasn't enough to destroy the garage to dig underneath it. So many tips were followed with so many disappointments. By 2002, Stacy's mom said she was 99% sure the women were gone. Over the next 2 decades, new information continued to come in, cadaver dogs continued to search new areas, and suspicious items were sent to DNA labs for processing. Some officers say that the case was so high profile that the police chief wouldn't let them use their own judgment, that he micromanaged everything to the point that the case wasn't handled properly. It's hard to say 30 years later, but the chief had come from the FBI. He had the right training, at least. Over the years, so many suspects have been closely examined, from Cheryl's 2 ex-husbands with a bone to pick, to her son with the police record, to Susie's ex-boyfriend who had a record, to the idea of it just being a random stranger and a crime of convenience. Let me talk about a few of these suspects. Bart Streeter was Susie's older brother who had problems with alcohol. When Susie lived with him for a time, they got into such an argument that she moved out. Neither she nor her mom, Cheryl, were on speaking terms with Bart when they disappeared. He said he was passed out drunk at home that night and has seemingly always cooperated with the police on the case. People continue to look at him, though, because in 2000, he was charged with kidnapping and coercion in Nevada. In 2019, he was arrested in Tennessee for drunkenly walking into a nail salon and trying to get a 15-year-old girl to leave with him by saying he was her grandfather. Luckily, she didn't recognize him and didn't go with him. The family denies this report and says he didn't forcibly do anything. 20-year-old Dustin Rukla was Susie's ex-boyfriend who was into drugs and had ties to the Galloping Goose Motorcycle Club, which would sometimes commit violent crimes. Dustin and 2 friends had been arrested for grave robbery in February 1992 when they reportedly broke the stained glass window of a local mausoleum, took a head from a corpse inside, and extracted $30 worth of gold fillings from it. Gross. Susie had given a statement against Rukla, and Cheryl was asked to testify about her car being used in the crime. Rukla later said that Cheryl had no involvement. One of the friends left town right after the disappearance of the 3 women, and Rukla and the other friend told police they wished the women were dead. But could stealing gold from the dead escalate into stealing 3 live women? Stephen Eugene Garrison, who was 33 years old at the time, knew Rukla and also claimed to be a biker outlaw. In 1995, he was sentenced to 40 years in prison for attacking a 20-year-old woman back in August 1993. She was a senior at Southwest Missouri State, the same school Stacy was going to attend in the fall. Garrison reached through her window, unlocked her door, and held her at knife point for 6 hours while he assaulted and otherwise terrorized her. According to the Springfield Daily Citizen, Garrison heard someone at a party confess to killing the women and taking their bodies to a farm. He had knowledge about the case that wasn't public knowledge, but nothing ever came of the searches based on his tips. Garrison is currently still serving his sentence in a Missouri state prison. Gerald Carnahan was a 34-year-old director of sales in Springfield who was a suspect in the 1985 assault and murder of a woman, the 1987 murder of a woman, and the 1988 murder of a woman. There was never any evidence tying Carnahan to those crimes, just some eyewitness tips. But in 1992, his wife got a restraining order on him once for abusing pills and becoming violent. In 1993, he was caught trying to kidnap an 18-year-old. That same year, he set fire to an aluminum casting facility, and he also once just let a car roll down a hill on purpose. He did a little time for the kidnapping, but didn't pay the price for any of the suspected murders, until 2007, when fresh DNA evidence linked him to that 1985 killing. In 2010, Carnahan received life in prison. When asked about the missing Springfield 3, he said he really had no idea where they ran off to, like it was their choice. Robert Craig Cox is the suspect you're most likely to have heard about because he actually admitted to the crime. He was an Army Ranger, a burglar, and a kidnapper, and in 1978, he was convicted of killing a 19-year-old woman on her way home from work at Disney World. They found her body in a sewer not 350 feet from the motel where 19-year-old Robert was staying on a family vacation with his parents. One of my favorite tidbits about this case is that when he came back to the hotel room that night he allegedly killed this woman, he claimed he bit down on his own tongue during a fight, but it was later determined that the inch of tongue he was missing had to have been bitten off by another person. So it sounds like that young Disney World employee went down swinging. One newspaper claims that Cox did time with Ted Bundy in Florida and had an incredible fascination with the serial killer. Either way, after a short time in prison, Cox's sentence there was overturned when the state Supreme Court said there wasn't enough evidence for him to have been convicted. He was released from death row in 1989 and was living in Springfield in 1992 when the women went missing. Police interviewed him just 2 weeks into their investigation, thanks to a tip from the mother of the Florida woman he'd been convicted of killing, but he said he had an alibi. He slept at his parents' house and then went to church with his girlfriend. When he was later arrested for robbery and the police interviewed him, he said that he knew the women were dead and that they were buried near Springfield. This is when his girlfriend was forced under oath to admit that he'd asked her to lie when she backed up his alibi. Surprise, surprise, there was no church. Over the years, Cox has admitted that he used to do utility work near Cheryl and Susie's home, and he also used to work at a used car dealership with Stacy's dad. Now, I thought this was just an internet rumor until I found a reputable newspaper interview with Cox that substantiated that story. But there's no proof that Cox ever met Stacy, and he said he didn't even know Stacy's dad because they worked in different departments. He says he'll give up all of the details he knows once his mother has passed away. Now, I don't know about you, but "I just know" doesn't work for me. He's probably the best suspect we have, but he just seems like an attention seeker to me. Cox has been convicted of a lot over the years and is currently serving a life sentence in a Texas prison for aggravated robbery. He'll be eligible for parole in 2025. And truly, that's just a smattering of what you'll see in online forums. Even the friend who went to Susie's house that morning when she wasn't answering the phone is seen as suspicious by some people. Here are a few thoughts and questions I have. It simply could have been a crime of convenience. The first officer on the scene said he smelled varnish when he walked into the house. If Cheryl was refinishing some furniture that night and had the windows open, someone could have just hopped in. We know that the women's purses were all stacked together on the steps down to Susie's sunken bedroom. Is that because the kidnapper told them it was a robbery and gathered them all in the bedroom before forcing them out of the house? It's a little odd that there was no sign of a struggle in the house, so maybe that means the women knew their abductor or abductors. Or do you think they actually went to the diner that night where the waitress said she recognized Cheryl? If this was Cheryl's favorite restaurant, the waitress probably would have known her face well. Maybe the high schoolers came home from their graduation parties after 2 a.m. and thought it would be fun to go out for fries with Susie's cool cosmetologist mom. And maybe they were hanging out in Susie's bedroom for a second while they all giggled over this plan, and then they just grabbed some cash and left their purses behind before getting abducted at the diner. Although then, how did the porch light globe get smashed? If you believe it was a targeted attack, not a crime of convenience, the target must have been Cheryl. The girls were supposed to be sleeping elsewhere that night, but had changed plans last minute, so the perpetrator wouldn't have known to find them at home. The internet loves to speculate about the fact that Susie's friend said in an interview that Susie was a creature of habit and always parked her car in the same spot at the house. But when her car was found abandoned in the driveway the day the women went missing, she was parked in a different way. It makes me wonder if she had to park that way because a visitor was in her usual spot. But if that's true, it wouldn't make any sense that damp washcloths were found in the clothes hamper, alluding to them all having cleaned their faces before bed. I can see a world where they all decide to go to the diner with freshly cleaned faces, but it's hard for me to imagine some perp being there with Cheryl when Susie and Stacy came home and giving them time to wash their faces before kidnapping them. I think partly this case has held its intrigue for so many decades because we know so much about it. At the time, the media was given access to everything. How the house looked, what tips had come in. They were even allowed to film the polygraph test given to two suspects. But having said that, there was actually so little to have access to. There's really almost no evidence in this case, and the evidence we do have could be meaningless. There was a broken porch light that was swept up before anyone could examine it for clues, and we put so much weight on that, this lost bit of information that obviously would have broken the case right open, at least in our minds. But truly, it could have exploded on its own from changes in temperature or some slight imperfection. There are also some phone calls and an answering machine message to lay all our hopes on. While Stacy's mom and the friends were searching Cheryl's house for the three women, the phone rang twice. Both times, it was a man who said what Stacy's mom called strange and disturbing, very rude, explicit things. Someone also left a similarly obscene message on the answering machine that day, but it was deleted without a thought. People are convinced these calls have such meaning, but as a person who grew up in the middle of nowhere, it seems to me that this could have just as easily been an ill-timed prank. We might never know. At the end of the day, the thing that really keeps this case compelling is that we can't possibly know what happened. There's no meaningful evidence, a bunch of suspects who kind of make sense, and so many rumors. And if you're thinking that I left out so many theories and rumors, you're right. I didn't include anything that I couldn't back up with writing from an actual news source. But that doesn't mean I don't want to hear your wildest, most outlandish theories about this case. Thank you for tuning into my podcast episode. I'm just a true crime fan like you are, and I really appreciate you taking a chance on me. Please subscribe and tell a friend if you like spending this time together. You can also find me on YouTube in the flesh by searching Katie Does Crime.